From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, director Paul Thomas Anderson talks about his new film, There Will Be Blood, starring Daniel Day-Lewis as an oil man in the early days of the oil industry, and Paul Dano as a boy preacher and faith healer. They each claim to have the power to transform people's lives, one through oil money, one through the Holy Spirit. The movie won the Best Film Award from the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. Anderson also made Boogie Nights and Magnolia. Also, our end-of-the-year wrap-up continues with the best in books and music. Maureen Carrigan gives her picks for fiction and nonfiction, and rock critic Ken Tucker tells us why he calls 2007 the year in rehabilitation. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Ladies and gentlemen, if I say I'm an oil man, you will agree. Now, I've traveled across half our state to be here and to see about this land. I'm a family man. This is my son and my partner, H.W. Plainview. I have many wells flowing at many thousand barrels per day. I can guarantee to start drilling and to put up the cash to back my word.
That's Daniel Day-Lewis as an oil man during the early days of the oil industry in the new movie, There Will Be Blood. My guest is the film's writer and director, Paul Thomas Anderson. He also made Boogie Nights, Hard Eight, Magnolia, and Punch Drunk Love. There Will Be Blood is on our film critic David Edelstein's 10 Best list, and it won the Best Film Award from the L.A. Film Critics Association. Reviewing it in The New Yorker, David Denby wrote, quote, "Anderson has now done work that bears comparison to the great achievements of D.W. Griffith and John Ford. There Will Be Blood is about the driving force of capitalism as it both creates and destroys the future, and the film's tone is at once elated and sickened," unquote. The movie is loosely based on the 1927 novel Oil by Upton Sinclair. Daniel Day-Lewis plays a silver prospector who discovers oil, then buys the rights to drill land in rural California by promising poor families he can transform their lives through the money oil will bring. But in one town, he meets a boy preacher and faith healer named Eli Sunday, who is also promising the townspeople he can transform their lives through his direct connections to the Holy Spirit. In this scene, the oil man, Daniel Plainview, is trying to convince the boy preacher and his father to let Plainview drill for oil on their land. The preacher is played by Paul Dano, who co-starred in Little Miss Sunshine as the silent brother.
My offer to you is $3,700.
What is it that brought you here, sir?
The good Lord's guidance. Now, of course, within that, we're going to develop a lease. What's that?
What about our oil?
What about it?
We have oil here. That's worth something.
Oh, do you have someone who can drill for it? Do you think there's oil here?
I know there is.
Oh, it's very expensive to drill. You know, to get it up and out of the ground. You ever tried that before?
How much is it?
Costly.
Well, our oil sits right up on top of the ground.
I believe that's called seepage. Doesn't necessarily mean there's anything underneath.
What would you give us for it?
I don't know.
Something you don't know.
That's right. What would you like, Eli?
$10,000.
For what?
For my church.
That's good. That's a good one. Well, if we decide to drill for oil, and if the well begins to produce, I'll give your church a $5,000 signing.
$10,000.
Do you want to find someone else that's going to come up here and drill, Eli? Make the investment and do all the hard work that goes into it?
Paul Thomas Anderson, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the movie. You know, an interesting thing about There Will Be Blood is that there's no real pleasure in the movie. I don't mean in watching the movie, but I mean the characters in the movie have no pleasure. There's very little eating. In the movie, there's no sex, there's no entertainment, and even the oil man, who becomes quite wealthy, doesn't seem to be interested in much that money can buy. He's interested in finding oil. That's his obsession. That's all he really seems to care about.
You know, it says something about the men of this period that were kind of on the tail end of the wild, wild west, who started as silver miners and kind of got into the oil business because that's what was happening. You know, that was what was in front of them. They could never really shake that ambition and that drive to work, that what they enjoyed the most was the fever, the insanity, just the process, that actually getting the stuff or the riches from it somehow was really unsatisfying to them. I that's my guess, because so many of them had this incredibly hard time transitioning into the 20th century. You know, they'd have these palatial mansions, but they'd still live like they were living in a tent, you know. So whatever they were after, once they got it, clearly wasn't satisfying their hunger, that they liked being hungry, that they probably preferred being hungry, you know. And I can only relate that when we were shooting the film to that's just what it's like when you're making a film. I mean, nothing compares to the joy of making them, When they're finished, it's a letdown somehow, you know, because it's over. But the joy and the drive and the insanity that you go through when you're making them, it's that fever that you get is the most enjoyable part of it. So we definitely were shooting what we were feeling.
Did you intentionally leave food out of the movie for the most part? And the food that's in it is so unappetizing.
Not really intentionally, no. I mean, there was one scene that we cut out really that caught Daniel sort of mid-bite. He was having a steak, and we cut it out, but we had to decide if Daniel was going to be doing anything in the last scene in the bowling alley, and I suggested that he be gnawing on a piece of steak, or at least what he could kind of get the nutrients of, considering that his teeth had probably fallen out, you know, just suck on a steak. And I knew it was a tall order because to do take after take and gnawing on a steak, you know, is really dangerous ground to get into. And Daniel went away for a few days and thought about it and said, all right, let's do the steak. That's a good idea, which is really happy. But besides that, anytime you can leave stuff like food out is a good thing, you know, because it just usually ends up being like a matching nightmare, or it just involves more people putting food on tables and stuff, and stripping it down to its essentials was not only the proper thing to do out there in that setting, you know, but really a cheat in making things easier, your life easier, just the making the film.
The way your movie is, it revolves around two people's stories. One of them is the independent oil man who becomes a millionaire through acquiring all this oil property. And then this, like, boy preacher who's a fundamentalist preacher and claims to be able to get rid of the devil, no matter where the devil is, in the room or in your body. And they're both great salesmen. They both have their pitches down. And they're both completely the opposite of each other in terms of what it is that they're pitching. And I guess what interested you in this dichotomy between the oil man and the boy preacher?
Well, it was first and foremost, it's a great boxing match.
Yeah.
You know.
And there's a couple of great scenes, which I'm not sure if I should give away or not, with the two of them.
Yeah. You know, they start out with their wits and their words, and then they start throwing punches. But just that idea of a boxing match, you know, was so terrific. It's funny because I'd originally thought it would be a good idea. It turned out it was not a good idea, but I had imagined the boy preacher is like, you know, like 12 or 13 years old, you know, that no matter what plain view, no matter what age somebody he was faced with, if somebody had his own same line of BS, you know, they were going to be a formidable opponent. We thought better of it. You know, we thought that would be a little bit absurd to have a 12 or 13-year-old boy, but the ideas remain the same, just to get them in the ring together.
There Will Be Blood is set in the late 19th and early 20th century, but the two kind of themes, two of the themes of the movie are so contemporary, you know, corporate obsession and power and religious obsession and power, still two of the driving forces in our country and our culture. I guess you were thinking about that a lot when you made the film.
Yeah, of course, but best to approach it like I said, like a boxing match or like a horror story, you know, rather than kind of this sort of the endless kind of punctuation that you could put on that kind of stuff that's there already. You know, you've got an oil man, you've got a preacher. Let the rest just be a fight to the death.
Daniel Day-Lewis has a reputation for being very obsessive about the few roles that he agrees to take on. What was it like to work with him? What can you tell us about his process and how you related to him as the director?
Well, in my eyes, Daniel's the holy grail of actors, you know, to work with somebody that is going to be that focused and dedicated without question to what he's doing. So I kind of couldn't wait to get my hands on him, really. You know, think, oh, boy, I hope I can do as well for you as I know you're going to do for me, just through the history of his performances. You know, my job is never to really ask what he's up to. My job is to really be, you know, to stand on the sidelines and be there if he needs me. I certainly don't feel like I need to understand anything that he doesn't need me to understand. I just need to answer a question if he's got one.
You know what I was wondering? The kid who plays his son, who must be, what, around 10 or something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was wondering, like, what did he know about Daniel Day-Lewis? And did he know that Daniel Day-Lewis was acting? Or did he think that he was just this, like, really intense, odd man?
No, I mean, you know, honestly, I think that he was probably more in touch with the idea of make-believe about it all than most adults would be, you know, who somehow have gotten so hung up about the idea of playing make-believe that it's bizarre. Why would you do that? You know, but why wouldn't you do that if you could do it for 3 months? I think the boy was feeling like, I'll do this with you for 3 months. This is my summer vacation, you know. The funny story is that the boy Dylan Fraser we found he's not an actor. He's just a young boy out there where we were shooting from West Texas. And his mother, when we first approached him, his mother wanted to figure out who Daniel Day-Lewis was, you know, considering, you know, she's going to be spending a lot of time with her boy. And she rented, you know, the worst case scenario, she rented Gangs of New York. And, you know, was kind of panicked.
He's quite a butcher in it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so, you know, of course, the casting girl rushes over a copy of Age of Innocence, you know, just to say, this is, wait, it's not like that. You know, it's all make-believe. And Daniel did speak to Dylan beforehand to say, you know, they had developed a bond already before we began shooting. And he did sit him down to speak with him to say, you know, there are going to be times when I'm going to speak very harshly with you. And Dylan looked at him like, what are you talking about? I get it. You don't have to tell me. I got it.
My guest is Paul Thomas Anderson. We'll talk more about writing and directing the new film There Will Be Blood after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Paul Thomas Anderson. He wrote and directed the new film There Will Be Blood, which stars Daniel Day-Lewis as a self-made oil tycoon. It's set in the oil fields of California in the late 1800s and early 1900s. You had to learn so much to recreate the period, and you had to learn a lot about the early days of oil exploration. Let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, like in the early part of the film, when the Daniel Day-Lewis character is first learning how to dig for oil, I mean, the technology is basically like a bucket on a pulley that he pulls up by hand, and then he deposits the oil in a big puddle by the well.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, and then things kind of grow a little from there. Go ahead.
Not all that stuff just comes from the written descriptions of how Edward Doheny first found oil right near Dodger Stadium near downtown L.A. They talk about starting out, usually they were essentially using what they knew as silver miners, which is you dig a hole. And then they realized they were down about, you know, 50, 60 feet and that they were choking on the fumes. So they say, well, we can't be down here to get this stuff up out of here. How are we going to do it? And they built an A-frame, you know, with a 50-foot eucalyptus tree that they shaved down and were just trying to drive it into the ground. I mean, these really primitive techniques. And the funny thing is, as much as it's changed, it's still kind of the same as it is today. It's just driving an enormous pole into the ground over and over and over again until, you know, you poke the monster enough and it erupts. But yeah, we just kind of were recreating things that were written about things that have been written down by people that were there, you know, saying we found the oil and we scooped it up with whatever we had, bottles and cans and saucepans, whatever it was, just that fever to get it up and out of the ground. They didn't even really have a place to put it, so they were just digging holes.
There are some really horrifying accidents that happen during the course of the movie while people are digging for oil. Did you study up on what typical accidents were like in those early oil days?
Yeah, we read about a few, you know, and then they're all so graphic. I mean, there were a few written about in Upton Sinclair's book, and then a few just from various other sources that we had. But then when we built the derrick and we got out there and we had this terrific guy named Jim Farmer, who's an old oil man who came out to help us out with some of the details of the drilling. And boy, once we met him, I mean, the stories just came fast and furious, you know. I mean, to the point where you just had kind of had enough. You're like, I don't need to hear about one more accident, you know. But quite honestly, you were aware of the dangers every single second, particularly when you've got a film crew around, you know, just... Everything was dangerous. The danger that something was going to fall, the danger that your fingers were going to get caught somewhere. I mean, it's horribly dangerous labor, and particularly out there where I think at the time these oil guys worked in 12-hour shifts. So for 12 hours they would work, and then they'd go to wherever the bar was and drink for 10 hours, sleep for 2 hours, probably stop at church on the way in, and then do it all over again, you know. So not only is there the danger just in general, but you factor in booze and heat and all the rest, and it's just—it's amazing.
So, is one of the accidents in the movie based on a story that you were told about a real accident or something that you read?
The bit falling was a character named Joe Gunda, who we meet very briefly. The bits fall, and he's down in a cellar, which is a place where they sort of collect the mud. That was from the Upton Sinclair book where I first read it, and then talking to some of our old timers and oil guys, they would just tell us endless stories about bits falling, guys drowning in the mud, and maybe they'd get hit in the head by something that fell, and that wouldn't be what killed them, but you know, drowning in this mud would be the thing that got them. Not to mention the work that they were doing, you know, high up. These derricks are 80 feet tall, so you know, from time to time, people would fall. And then, I mean, and we're not even factoring in what happens when these things do come in. Ideally for them, they knew when they were coming in. They knew they'd sort of hit a certain sand that they were looking at and smelling and saying, okay, we're very close. And they could prepare, however they did prepare, for the gusher to come in. But those times when a gusher would come in, they didn't know it. I mean, you were in trouble. You were in a lot of trouble, particularly if it lit on fire, and anything could light it on fire. Just a rock shooting up out of the ground could be a spark that could catch a flame.
And that happens in the movie, and there's this huge fire that erupts after the gusher starts gushing. And I'm thinking about how challenging that scene must have been to create. First of all, I don't know if an oil fire burns differently than, say, a wood fire or any other fire, and if you had to make sure that you were creating an oil fire so that the fire would look authentic.
Yeah, well, black smoke is the key. You know, oil burns black, and we were using diesel fuel, and it burned pretty darn close to how real crude oil would burn. And we augmented it a little bit with some digital effects, just helping to kind of darken it a little bit, but it sure felt like the real thing. And when we did it, and, you know, we had a special effects guy, a terrific guy named Steve Kremens, and whose job it was to get thousands of gallons of diesel fuel spouting up in the air and then to light it on fire. And he said to us, you know, I cannot guarantee that I can put this fire out. I can do it and I can turn it off. But once that derrick catches on fire, there's a chance I might not be able to put it out. We thought he was just playing it safe, you know, that would be. But the second we lit the match, it was clear there was no way we were going to be able to put it out because the wood was so dry. There was so much gasoline. And we were essentially forced to do that entire sequence within two takes in about 45 minutes before the derrick tumbled to the ground.
Did you know how you wanted to shoot it, like what you wanted the look to be? And do you have favorite, like, fire scenes from other movies that inspired the look that you were going after?
Yeah, you know, you become pretty referenceless out there when you have to do something like that, because, you know, we had about five or six cameras going, and first and foremost, you're putting them in a safe place. Second, you're trying to get a shot that can carry through the whole thing. So all those kind of film references or any big ideas you come up with just go completely out the window. You know, you're just there really trying to film this event that's going to happen, you know, with or without you.
Yeah, and the fire is alive. I mean, so you're shooting something that has a life of its own.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't take direction very well.
Right.
But that's what's fun about it, too. You know, it's great. I mean, we were so nervous leading up to lighting that fire because, first of all, we were in love with our Derek. You know, we're so proud of it. And we knew we were going to be completely melancholy when it was gone. Mixed in with that, we were all completely petrified at the prospect of screwing it up. I mean, what are you going to do? We're not going to build it again. That wasn't going to happen, you know. And obviously, we were pretty careful. We weren't going to do it if the wind was blowing too much. But to be really honest with you, it was kind of one of the benefits of shooting out in West Texas, because they're a lot looser out there. You know, I don't think we could have done anything like that in California. They would have had a heart attack out there.
Paul Thomas Anderson wrote and directed the new film There Will Be Blood, as well as Boogie Nights, Magnolia, and Punch Drunk Love. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Ship of Ghosts, the story of the USS Houston by James Hornfisher. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting the Irish rock film Once on DVD Tuesday. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the best books of the year, as chosen by our book critic, Maureen Carrigan, and the best recordings of the year, as chosen by our rock critic, Ken Tucker. And we continue our conversation with Paul Thomas Anderson about writing and directing the new film, There Will Be Blood. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with screenwriter and director Paul Thomas Anderson. He made Boogie Nights, Magnolia, and Punch Drunk Love. His new film, There Will Be Blood, stars Daniel Day-Lewis as an oil man in the early days of the industry who goes from one poor town to another, persuading people to lease their oil-rich land to him. He's a gifted salesman obsessed with building his oil empire. He's not sure what to make of it when a drifter shows up claiming to be a long-lost brother, but is so unlike him. You can hear those differences in this conversation. The brother is played by Kevin J. O'Connor.
Are you an angry man, Henry?
About what?
Are you envious? You get envious.
I don't think so, no.
I have a competition in me. I want no one else to succeed. I hate most people.
That part of me is gone. Working and not succeeding. All my failures has left me. I just don't care.
Well, if it's in me, it's in you. There are times when I look at people and I see nothing worth liking. I want to earn enough money I can get away from everyone.
There Will Be Blood is a great title, and the blood refers to the blood from oil accidents, the blood ties of family, and there's, of course, the blood of Christ. And the boy preacher says, you'll never be saved if you reject the blood. But I kept waiting in the movie for somebody to say, there will be blood. No one says it. So I'm wondering.
I had a friend, Terry, that that would anytime he would go to see a film and the title of the film was said on screen, he would scream out in the audience this horrible, obnoxious noise. He'd say, "Bacaw!" really loud. So, I just always remember, I was like, oh, God, if I ever put that, my friend would scream from the back of the audience.
So how'd you come up with the title?
Just writing down titles as I was writing the movie, you know, trying to, you know, you kind of keep a piece of paper nearby and writing things down as they come to you, and wrote that one down. And I remember writing it down thinking, that looks pretty good. It looks good, you know, which is probably halfway towards a good title if it looks good on you know, pen and paper. And then had a bunch of others that lingered around, but just kept coming back to that.
The cinematographer that you worked with on There Will Be Blood is Robert Elswit, who shot your other films too, right?
Yeah.
And he also did Good Night and Good Luck, which looks great.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us an example of an idea that he came up with where you thought, yep, that's it?
Well, Robert and I have worked together so long, which is, it's such a bizarre, dysfunctional relationship at this point, but great, but just the closest collaborator I have, really. Robert loves to linger around in the background for as long as he possibly can, you know, without saying much of anything. And he loves to really be involved, not saying too much about, you know, shots or anything like that, or lighting. He likes to just kind of linger and let Jack build his sets and lets everybody do their work. He gets real busy about scheduling because he's very, very smart about knowing how much time we should have to do stuff. And those are always the aha moments with Robert. When Robert says, we need 2 days, everybody says, we need 2 days.
In your new movie, There Will Be Blood, is it's in a way like working with one hand tied behind your back, because the new movie, there's no irony. It's not set in the present, so there's no like pop culture references. There's no contemporary pop songs in the background. And those are some of the hallmarks of your films that you've become known for. Was that intentional for you? Did you want to leave that stuff behind and try something completely different?
You know, Tim, maybe it's the opposite. Maybe it feels like I got one hand untied from behind my back. So I got both hands to work with, because that's a little bit more what it feels like. Yeah, you always want to do something different. Always. I do, you know. And, I've always thought we did do something different, and I'm sure to varying degrees of success or what people's impressions are. But at the same time, you know, maybe never being satisfied that we did enough, or being frustrated that it looks like we made it, sounds like we made it, and God, I wish you could just crawl out of your skin and not have it look like that. But,
well, what was the hand that got untied?
Well, working with a book was like having a great collaborator. You know, the films that I love are very straightforward stories, and my instincts, maybe left to my own devices as a storyteller, are less straightforward. So maybe untying myself from myself and being open to adapting a book or, you know, working with a story that has happened already was really liberating. I mean, we all know what happens with oil, don't we? We know what the end of the story is. It's a bit like the Titanic. We know that it sinks. You know, the fun is going to be watching it, how it gets there. So there's a kind of, there's something very liberating in working in that venue.
The music that was composed for the film is by Johnny Greenwood of Radiohead, and parts of it are electronic, or at least that's how they sound to me, and parts of it are symphonic but kind of discordant. And you've chosen, in parts, a kind of avant-garde music as the soundtrack for the past. And I thought that was an interesting choice that actually works really well. Can you talk a little bit about why you chose that approach musically?
Yeah, I mean, all credit goes to Johnny, really. I'd heard pieces that he'd written for orchestra that sounded like the movie, a movie that I hadn't made, you know, yet. But I thought, my God, it's so spooky and so unsettling. And there was sort of nowhere to hide from it. And I thought, well, that's how the music should be for the film. And it's funny that you feel like there was electronic music, because some of it maybe sounds like that, but none of it is. It's all orchestra.
Well, there's one period of like a sustained sound, and I couldn't figure out whether it was like strings or electronics.
That is a cheat. That is Johnny playing an Ondas Martin Note, which is an early synthesizer, early 20th century synthesizer. That only he seems to know how to play really well. Anyway, that's a terrific sound. That it shouldn't match up, but it does somehow. I can't quite figure out why, but Johnny wrote this little piece on piano with the Ondas Martin Note and just a 2-minute kind of demo, and sent it to me, and I put it up against the film and sent it to him back, and he was kind of shocked that it worked too. We both were.
I read that for Robert Altman's last film, the Prairie Home Companion movie, that you were like the standby director, and it made it seem like you were standing by in case something happened to Altman. And it did turn out to be his last film. Was there this fear that he wouldn't survive the movie?
He was going through chemotherapy and radiation during that film, and Bob was indestructible, so nobody that knew him really well knew that anything would happen. But every Thursday he would go and get his treatments. So, and the funny thing is, Terry, he didn't miss a day. He didn't miss one day. We shot for 32 or 33 days. And there was one day about 5:30, as opposed to, you know, 6:30, when we would normally finish, when he said, okay, I'm done, I'm going to go home. But one day out of 35 days, and he was 84 years old and getting cancer treatments and just so powerful and having the time of his life. That's Bob in a nutshell there. But yeah, I got to stand right there and be there. We had a ball.
How did you first meet him?
Through Dylan Titchener, who's my editor, had worked as an assistant editor, apprentice editor, and just around Bob's office for years and years. So the first time I met him was through Dylan. Was watching, was at a screening of Shortcuts. And, needless to say, I was, what Bob's films meant to me, I was really not overwhelmed at all, because he didn't overwhelm you, you know. I mean that as a compliment, you know. That wasn't his style. He was very quick to be very nice to me, which, you know, he didn't have any reason to be. It was just, he just was. And I think so fondly of him. Think about him all the time.
What are some of the things that you learned from him?
I think I learned to mellow out a little bit more, or definitely mellowed out at his encouragement. Watching him really kind of enjoy things disintegrating on the set, he really loved that. he never imposed his will, but at the same time, he got exactly what he wanted. So figure that one out, you know. And it came through his... I got to watch him in pre-production, and he was a master of kind of not answering the questions that were being asked of him, but not as a way of not committing, but as a way of just seeing where things were going to lead, you know, putting things off until just the right moment when he thought, okay, this is where I think this should go. That's that costume that we should be wearing, or it's that way we should light the scene, or whatever it was. He was a kind of master at letting everything else navigate for a long, long time until he saw a moment to step in and give some guidance.
Well, Paul Thomas Anderson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry. It's great.
Paul Thomas Anderson wrote and directed the new film There Will Be Blood. It won the Best Film Award from the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. Coming up, our book critic Maureen Corrigan chooses the best books of the year. This is Fresh Air. Populism is a running theme in this year's run-up to the presidential primaries, and according to our book critic Maureen Corrigan, many of this year's best books had a populist slant as well. Here are her best books of the year.
Chances are that many working-class Americans are having an anxious holiday season this year. The number of Americans without health insurance continues to climb, and the inequality of wealth and income has increased tremendously. But in books, if not in life, it was a great year for the working class. Richard Russo, who's made his mark writing about ordinary working stiffs in small upstate New York towns, gave us Bridge of Sighs, a big, fat, juicy package of realistic fiction wrapped up in butcher paper and tied off with string. The hero of Russo's latest novel is Lewis Lynch, unfortunately nicknamed Lucy, who runs the corner grocery store that his parents bought with their life savings in the 1950s. That grocery store is a clean, well-lighted place in a world of random evil, and Russo's quietly revelatory tale of the events that have taken place in and around the store over 60 years is a miracle of the mundane. Minjin Lee's Free Food for Millionaires is a sprawling wonder of a New York City novel that tells the class-climbing story of Casey Han, the Princeton-educated daughter of Korean immigrants who run a dry cleaning shop. Lee's Korean-American riff on the traditional concerns of the 19th century novel, money, marriage, and duty, is terrifically funny and enlightening. Roddy Doyle returned this year with a new book, Paula Spencer, named for the heroine of his 1996 novel, The Woman Who Walked Into Doors. Paula is now almost 50 and definitely not a beneficiary of Ireland's much ballyhooed economic boom. Her core of self-deprecating resolve helps Paula stick to her job as a cleaning lady, and her voice, wry, bitter, often punched up with obscenities, makes readers stick by her side. I loved Stuart Onan's new novella, Last Night at the Lobster, set in a Red Lobster restaurant on the day before it's scheduled to shut down on orders from corporate headquarters. Our hero is Manny De Leon, the 35-year-old manager who has to get his restaurant through one more day while a blizzard builds outside, and inside, employees desert faster than you can say, hold the tartar sauce. Granted, not every wonderful novel this year wore a blue or pink collar. The Other Side of You by Sally Vickers details the relationship between a psychiatrist and his patient, and it's written in that subtle, specifically female British tradition of Penelope Lively, Iris Murdoch, and Anita Bruckner. All these women write intelligently about characters whose relatively placid exteriors mask roiling inner lives. Speaking of brainy Brits, Ian McEwan popped up again with On Chesil Beach, another minor masterpiece of rumination and restraint. The French female mystery writer Fred Vargas was a fantastic find for me this year. Her intricate police procedural, Wash This Blood From My Hands, is now available in paperback, and happily, a translation from the French of another one of her mysteries will be out this spring. Last but not least on this year's fiction list is Anne Patchett's Run, a kind of realistic fairy tale about a father and his two adoptive sons that's a dazzling successor to Patchett's literary blockbuster, Bel Canto. Adoption was also the topic of one of my favorite nonfiction books of the year, A.M. Holmes's The Mistress's Daughter. In her compelling memoir, Holmes attests to both the undeniable power of blood and to random miracles of affinity. I also like the haunting biography of Thomas Hardy by Claire Tomalin, which details the life of one of literature's great gloomy Gusses, a man who seemed doomed to yearn most intensely for that which was out of reach. Arnold Rampersad's biography of Ralph Ellison was, for me, the nonfiction book of the year, a vivid and authoritative exploration not only of Ellison, but also of racial identity and mid-20th century American literary culture. Just to keep my Grinch critical credentials polished, I'll confess that this was a year where I dutifully read a lot of books that I ended up thinking were overrated. Among them, Dennis Johnson's cliched Vietnam epic Tree of Smoke, which won the National Book Award, and Juno Diaz's okay enough but not fabulous Spanglish tale, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. One writer, though, who deserves all the accolades that can be piled atop him is Philip Roth. His short new novel, Exit Ghost, is so smart, so funny, so elegiac, so, oh, please, people, just give Roth the Nobel Prize in Literature already and make 2008 a year to celebrate.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Her list can be found on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Coming up, the best recordings of the year, as chosen by our rock critic, Ken Tucker. This is Fresh Air. Although rock critic Ken Tucker has been listening to a wide range of music in an increasingly fragmented pop marketplace, he settled on a theme he believes can summarize much of 2007. He calls it the year in rehabilitation.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no. I'm fine. Just try to make me go to rehab. I won't go, go, go.
The British singer Amy Winehouse's Rehab was released here early this year, and as 2007 wore on, it dominated the pop landscape. First and foremost, it's the best single of the year, at once a throwback to 60s pop and a lurch forward. Its neo-soul was one of the most fruitful examples of an alternative to the barrenness of hip-hop's thuggish strain. Of course, by the end of the year, Winehouse had become nearly as famous for her alleged substance abuse problems, which caused the cancellation of at least part of a promotional tour. And so her wonderful song took on a sour irony, a sad contrast to the tart alertness of her vocal on Rehab. Then there was the singer who seemed to desperately need even more rehab, who gave a groggy, awful performance at the MTV Video Awards and still managed to put out a very good album with at least one Best of the Year song.
I'm a American dream since I was 17. Don't matter if I step on the scene or slink away to the Philippines. They still gon' put pictures of my derriere in the magazine. You want a piece of me? You want a piece of me? This bad media karma, another day, another drama. Guess I can't see the harm in working and being a mom. And with a kid on my arm, I'm still an exception. You want a piece of me?
Britney Spears' Piece of Me was the year's most convincing bit of I'm caught in the trap of fame and I can't get out music. I know I'm not going to convince most of you that some of the best songs of the year came from supposed teen pop idols like Britney, Ally and AJ, Ashley Simpson, and yes, Miley Cyrus working her Hannah Montana TV character. And who'd have thought Billy Ray Cyrus's daughter would launch a tour that rivaled Bruce Springsteen's for ticket sale popularity? But all of these young performers had what too much rock and hip-hop lacked this year, an unironic emotionalism, an open-heartedness, and an interest in really figuring out what it means to be in love.
Yesterday I spotted you hanging out with someone new. Come on, dude, I can't believe who. Did it hurt? Oh, yes, it hurt, but not as much as I thought it would. Guess it's time for me to move on. I'm getting close.
Meanwhile, my favorite album of the year came from musicians at the opposite extreme from teen pop. I'm talking about the now peerless brother-sister duo that comprises the band Fiery Furnaces. Siblings Matthew and Eleanor Friedberger fracture lyrics and time signatures. Many of their compositions sprawl well over 5 minutes. But they have none of the pompousness we associate with 20th century art rock. This year, Fiery Furnaces put out Widow City, which both extended their verbal and musical experiments and graciously included some of their catchiest riffs.
Well, I got warnings from jealous friends. Cases of borrowed clothes and a violent time with me from my mother. And she said, forget what mom likes, cause things have changed. Told me how to make booze at home. Call it old uncle Zeke and drink it early next week. If there's anything I've had enough of, it's today. If there's anything I've had enough of, it's today. If there's anything I've had enough of, it's today.
Rehabilitation in the form of rejuvenation occurred in country music. This is the rare year where I didn't have to seek out old pros for good country. Not when singers such as Miranda Lambert, Sarah Johns, Kelly Willis, and Taylor Swift, look at that, all women, were making tense, strong-willed, exciting albums. No one did it with more cleverness than Miranda Lambert, who stole thunder from the wildest old country outlaws to create her biggest hit.
It took me 5 bars, some 30 license plates.
Girlfriend. 2007 was also the year that Radiohead released its new album, not through a record company, but on the internet via a pay-what-you-like honor system. It was a fascinating experiment, not one that a struggling new band could emulate without starving, but a decisive sign that the way we consume music also affects the way we think about artists and their work. Overall, this was one of the most confounding, constantly shifting years I've experienced since I started covering music. Does this leave me confused or annoyed? To quote Amy Winehouse, no, no, no. Happily off balance and exhilarated is more like it.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. You can see Ken's complete 10 best list on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. We'll close with one of Ken's favorite tracks of the year, Teddy Thompson singing Change of Heart from his CD Up Front and Down Low. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Well, I guess you must have had a change of heart. You don't treat me like you did at the start. Your campaign of love was quite a work of art. Now I guess you must have had a change of heart. Guess I took too much for granted. So long ago, you swore we'd never part. Now I guess you must have had a change of heart.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. And from Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching, at breakthroughcollaborative.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm gonna walk.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen to some rare gospel recordings and talk about them with Robert Darden, founder of the Gospel Music Restoration Project. And director Ridley Scott talks about his latest film, American Gangster, and the new edition of Blade Runner. Join us for the next Fresh Air.